We've been discussing Guru Tattva and discussing many things. One of the things we've been discussing is that there's Diksha and Siksha Gurus, so one could have many gurus, or at least more than one. And then I wanted to explain something that I think is important to understand. In the Bhagavatam, there's a verse, it says, Acharya mam vijaniyat, navamanyeta karichet namartyabhu jasuyeta, sarvadeva mayo guru. And this is a verse that says the Acharya or the guru is to be seen as myself. And I think we mentioned this in a previous class. What's important is it's not only that the guru is seen as a representative of Krishna. So in that sense, Krishna says, see him as myself, see him non-different than me. The king is also seen that way. And Prabhupada gives the example, and I explained this before, that the viceroy used to represent government, and he would be given presents when he would visit other countries. Sometimes he would be given valuable jewels, but he wouldn't keep anything. It was always delivered to the government. So the viceroy represents the government, so in that sense he is the government to the people. So guru represents Krishna, so in that sense he is Krishna to that person. The mother and the father and the teacher and the guest, according to Vedic culture, they also represent Krishna. It said you should see the guest as God. And treat the guest like God. Even if the guest comes uninvited, which is called atiti, still, you treat him like God. And the mother, the father. And then in Bhagavatam, we also mentioned Bhagavatam, guru na sasyat, svajani na sasyat. Don't become a guru, don't become a relative. Pita na sasyat, don't become a father. Don't become a mother. Unless you can deliver your dependents. So it was a natural position. The parents would be the guru for the children, and in traditional society, the women did not take diksha from a guru. It was the boys who took diksha. They were trained by the guru, and then they became the guru for the wife. That was a very traditional system, and that's how the women had access to spiritual knowledge, through the husband. So then the husband was the guru, God's representative. Now, you know, when we think of gurus, sometimes we think, you see in India, some of these gurus ride on elephants. So you think, you know, great pomp, but it's not always like that. Traditionally, guru meant he had an ashram. Guru was a householder, lived with his wife. And then the young boys, the brahmacharis, would live there and serve him, and he would train them. So it was like a little bit like a school. So of course, there was great honor and respect given, but it varied according to the guru and the situation. And so how we honored Srila Prabhupada was quite special. And generally, outside of the Vyas Puja celebration, generally gurus are not worshipped on that level. Even, as we mentioned before, even when Prabhupada was first offered his Vyasasan, he didn't accept it because he didn't feel qualified. Because the tradition was that gurus generally didn't sit on big seats, except on their maybe Vyas Puja day. So even Prabhupada initially was reluctant to accept it, but as the founder of Acharya, he did accept it. And he did accept to be worshipped every day in Guru Puja, but that was never done before. So Prabhupada set a standard a bit higher than what was traditionally done, so that we sometimes think, well, that's the standard. But sometimes it was as simple as a teacher with students. And so therefore, the father also is the guru because he's instructing the children. The husband's also the guru. In traditional times, helping the wife, that was her access to spiritual knowledge. He studied the Vedas, she didn't. In those days, you couldn't study the Vedas if you didn't have a guru, if you weren't initiated. And so the women didn't have that access. And then the mother is said to be the first guru. The king is called Naradev, God on earth, because he represents God, because he establishes Dharma. So he represents the Shastra. Dharma is established, Dharma Sakshad Bhagavat Pranitam. Dharma is established by Krishna. So then now the king represents Krishna. So it's important, I think, in understanding Guru as God, to not isolate it as only, there's only one Guru, but the Guru manifests through different persons in different relationships. This also brings up the concept of which Prabhupada wrote in Vyasa Puja offering to his spiritual master, that the Guru is one. And so what did Prabhupada mean that? By that, because gurus are different individuals. So yes, individually they're different and they may have different relationships, but oneness in the sense that they all represent Krishna. And they all represent the tattva, what Krishna is speaking, that is what guru speaks. So that in that sense, guru is one. That's why Krishna says, Acharya mam vijaniya, you should understand that I am the Acharya. Because just like if whatever you're learning today, you went out and taught it, then you'd be teaching exactly what I taught. And so, in a sense, you could say we're representing Mahatma, or we are Mahatma, we're Mahatma's representatives, because we're teaching what he taught. So, Guru is teaching what Krishna taught. So in that sense, they're all one. In that sense, if you represent somebody else, you're all one because you're representing what he teaches. And that's why Prabhupada so many times said, if you want to be guru, it's not difficult, you just don't change. And what your guru said, and Prabhupada said, that's my qualification, I never changed anything. So in that sense, Prabhupada would say, being guru is easy. Of course, you might say, well, I couldn't be a guru, this and that. Maybe we couldn't be a guru because we couldn't deal with the honor. That's another thing. But we're all meant to be gurus, as we said in an earlier class, we're all meant to be gurus by what? By siksha guru. Amar agai guru hana tada edesh. Mahaprabhu says, I'm my order to become guru. And so I mentioned in this class something very interesting, that when we hear that, a lot of devotees don't understand, they don't relate to that. But what does Prabhupada mean, become guru? No, everywhere you go, you teach people about Krishna. This way you become guru. So that verse defines what is guru. Whoever you meet, tell them about Krishna. So then Prabhupada elaborates on that, as you've heard from your guru. And of course, you have to follow your guru. So when Prabhupada was asked, who is going to be your successor? He never appointed a successor. He said all of them, whoever is the best follower, whoever follows, he can be the next successor. And Prabhupada didn't mean only one successor. He meant whoever follows, they all can be successors, because that's the qualification. So you understand what your guru said, you follow it. Now you're guru. Not that difficult. Everybody thinks it's difficult. Why? Because guru is honored, and of course it's a big responsibility, and guru has to set a good example. But these are all things we should be doing anyway, shouldn't we? Setting a good example, following, understanding what Srila Prabhupada is teaching. So, I'm going to go back to my word file and continue reading a little bit. So the next section is who can be a guru. I think we covered that in earlier classes. And one of the things that Prabhupada said in 1969 is that I want all my disciples to become guru. Hopefully by 1975, that was, I believe, in a letter. Which was kind of, in a sense, from our perspective, kind of startling. I think when Prabhupada said that, Prabhupada said a lot of things to his earlier, younger devotees in the early days of the movement that they didn't understand, so it wasn't, sometimes it wasn't even like an issue, because there were so many things we didn't understand, so it was just another one, and we had faith that if we needed to understand it, then we would understand, or Prabhupada would explain it further. So it wasn't like anyone was really worried about that. But later on, of course, 1975 came, and no one had become guru, and Prabhupada didn't talk about it until he was getting ready to leave this world. And then he said, when I'm present, don't initiate, and then when I leave, you can accept disciples. That was the basic instruction. And he said, a simple thing, repeat what I've said, repeat Shastra, repeat Sadhu, and follow. And then he stressed that follow, because obviously it's easier to repeat than it is to follow. But it was kind of an open order that anyone can do this if they repeat and they follow. And then the idea was, if you repeat well and you follow and you're teaching, then some people will eventually see you like a guru or a guide or a mentor. Guru doesn't mean you have to give diksha. Guru can be siksha, just one who gives instruction. So when Prabhupada said become guru, first thing he meant was siksha guru, and then diksha, if necessary, if you're qualified, if that's the service you want to render, and if there are people who want to take diksha from you, then that was an option. So that's kind of how Prabhupada left it. And then the GBC felt somewhat responsible to monitor that, so unqualified people or people who were not faithful to Prabhupada or faithful to ISKCON wouldn't create havoc, so they wanted to ensure some standards of people who would become gurus. So then they began monitoring, and that's changed over the years, and it's still actually in flux right now, because the discussion, it's a little difficult discussion, because if you weren't in an organization, then there'd be no organization to monitor what you're doing. But because you're acting within an organization and you have control over people, then the organization feels responsible in some way to monitor who they're allowing to do this. But in traditional Vedic society, of course, some people were born as Brahmins, and Brahmins are naturally teachers, and so they were known as gurus. But still, Jiva Goswami says that before one accepts a guru, one should live with the guru for a year and study and see if the guru is qualified, which would presuppose that somebody knows what are the qualifications of a guru, which would then mean that you have to study shastras which explain what are the qualifications of a guru. Now, in ISKCON, it's a little bit less of studying the qualifications of a guru and more studying whether one is compatible with a specific guru. Because most devotees assume that if one is in ISKCON and one is initiating, then and one has disciples, they must be qualified, and I think that some devotees might feel that it would even be offensive to question whether or not that person is qualified. So for most devotees in choosing guru, it's more a matter of inspiration and faith. Sometimes it's a matter of if that guru is accessible locally, or if I need a guru is accessible. There are different considerations. But still, Jiva Goswami says, and I go back and see if anyone said anything. If you want to say anything, you can say, or ask a question, you can do that on chat. But still, Jiva Goswami says the tradition is the disciple spends a year with the guru, which I don't know what guru is going to let you travel with him for a year, but that was the tradition. And then the guru would also study the disciple, see if the disciple is ready. So it worked both ways. So GBC, what they've done to allow, what should we say, what they've done to establish or try to follow this instruction by Jiva Goswami they have a process by which one can be, they don't want to use the word authorized, one can be allowed to initiate in ISKCON based on just the fact that they accept that this is a devotee in good standing, and therefore by Prabhupada's order that all my disciples should initiate, this person has been a devotee a long time, he works within the organization, and therefore, or he cooperates with the organization, and therefore we allow him, so to speak, to initiate. And then, but what they've also said, of course, I don't know if anybody actually reads the resolutions, but what they've also said is that it's not an endorsement of the qualifications of this person as a devotee or qualifications as a guru, but that's something the disciple needs to. You know, in other words, if a disciple chooses someone to be their guru and the guru ends up having trouble, then what they're trying to say is that you should not feel that just by virtue of the fact that we've allowed this person to initiate an ISKCON, it doesn't mean that he's infallible, and it doesn't mean that he may have trouble, and that's something for you to test or see or feel. Maybe you were with this person and yeah. Hold on. Little message here. So now you have to tolerate these ads. I don't know, maybe you can tell me, I don't know, if the ads all come up at the same time for everyone, then you can let me know, and then I can stop talking. Or maybe Krishna doesn't want you to hear what I'm saying. Anyway, this is being recorded, so I have a YouTube channel. So I'll just let you know. This is being recorded and will go up on my YouTube channel. When we get it on Mayapur TV, it'll go right up on my website. Which is really good. So what the GBC is saying, it's the responsibility of the disciple, ultimately, to determine if this guru is qualified, at least qualified for you, or even qualified in general. Because some of the gurus have left their service, they felt unqualified to do it or continue it, or you know, some of them have even left Krishna consciousness, and so they want, of course, sometimes you can't know that will happen, but at least they want the disciple to know that it's not, by allowing somebody to initiate an ISKCON, it's not a, should we say, a verification that here is an advanced devotee or a statement that this devotee may not have problems or so forth. And it's a little, you know, it's an awkward situation. What we're dealing with. Anyway, now that we're on the topic of disciple, I thought it would be important for me to just share what I've noticed. And sometimes we've heard something along the line that different gurus on different levels, when they plant the seed of bhakti within your heart. Of course, that's an analogy. It's not actually a seed. But the analogy is given in the Chaitanya Charitamrita that at the time of diksha, the seed is planted, and then you water it with hearing and chanting. And then the seed blossoms. So it's an analogy. But still, sometimes, using this analogy, And sometimes using this analogy, some people have said outside of ISKCON that according to the level of the guru, the seed is more powerful. The seed is more powerful, but it's not actually true, because the seed that is given within the cyclic succession. And so we're all giving the same seed. Now, instructions, of course, one guru's instructions may be more powerful than another, that for sure. But one is connected to the cyclic succession through diksha. Now, if one thinks that everything depends on diksha, or everything depends on my diksha guru and his adhikari, and his elevation, which some people believe that to be true, it's not true, but I mean it's true in the sense, for any devotee that you associate with, the more they're advanced, the more you benefit, and your instructions, hearing from them, it will be more elevated, more penetrating. But in terms of receiving, taking shelter of a guru in terms of diksha, that's equal. So that means, therefore, the advancement is not dependent on the guru, but it's dependent on the disciple. It's not dependent on the seed that the guru manifests, but it's dependent on the fertility within the heart of the disciple. Because, and this is my, I'm just bringing this up because this is my experience. I see this all the time with sincere disciples, dedicated disciples. They make advancement. They hear well, they serve well, they serve the Vaishnavas, they have a good relationship with their spiritual master, they have a good relationship with other devotees. They advance nicely. But if someone's not in the right consciousness, then it doesn't matter how great their guru is. It's really, they're the receptacle of the mercy that the guru gives. So they have to be able to hold that. They have to be able to respond to it. So we'll see. It doesn't mean just because one was initiated by Bhaktivinoda Thakur or Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur or Srila Prabhupada, who are these great Mahabhagavats, that they're in a better position than one who was initiated by someone who came after Srila Prabhupada. It's subjectively may be better because this guru may be more inspirational to you. Okay, that's of course valid. But that's a subjective thing, and it doesn't mean that if you had the same relationship with another guru and the same dedication, it wouldn't mean that you wouldn't advance as rapidly or in the same way. Now, I made the point yesterday, I mean not yesterday, in the last class, that there's this statement that has really confused a lot of people, that Prabhupada said you have to, if you don't take shelter of an Uttama Adhikari, if you take shelter of a Madhyam or Kanishtha, their guidance will be insufficient. And so people have used this to say, well, Prabhupada's disciples are not qualified, you need to find someone who's an Uttama Adhikari, and there aren't any Uttama Adhikaris in ISKCON, so you need to go outside of ISKCON. That's not what Prabhupada meant. Within ISKCON, we have the siksha of so many Uttama Adhikaris. And so, if you say, well, there's no Uttama Adhikaris, so your guidance will be insufficient, then is Prabhupada's guidance insufficient? Of course not. Is the guidance that we get from Bhagavatam insufficient? Of course you can say, but you need to be guided by people who understand the Shastra. Okay, that's true. But is there any insufficient guidance within ISKCON? Are we so ignorant that we actually don't understand what Prabhupada said after 40 years? We still... No, that's not true. So we are all being guided by Uttama Adhikari. So there's no lack of that instruction. So it goes back to us, the faith that we have in hearing those instructions, the mentality we have of submission to hearing, not just from our guru, but from all those we hear from, and the mood to serve and to hear humbly and serve humbly. That's the real qualification for the disciple. Now, you might say, is, I don't know if you can see this. If I keep getting a message that says that quality is too high. We already have it on low quality. Quality is too high for our connection. Anyway, so then the question will come. You say, well, if it's really the disciple, then does it really matter what guru I accept? I mean, if one's as good as the next, does it really matter? And in a broad sense, I would say, and of course everyone may not agree with me, I would say, okay, I'll qualify this. I'm going to say the first half of it, and then I'll qualify it and balance it with the second half. But let me say first, in theory, it doesn't matter. If the guru is bona fide, and you have faith in that guru, and you hear and serve, and that guru properly represents Srila Prabhupada and Gaudiya Vaishnavism, Siddhanta, it doesn't matter. All of them are good. It's just like you go to school, and if all the teachers are good, then any class you go from, you'll learn the subject. Now, if you don't have faith in a teacher, or that teacher doesn't inspire you, or you don't feel a connection with that teacher, you may not be able to learn so well. So naturally, you want to go in the class with the teacher, with the way they teach, the way they relate to you, the way they understand you, helps you. So that's also natural that we find, at least this is what I see, what I'm observing, that some people just have a natural, they're naturally inspired by certain devotees, so they're inclined to hear from them. Because faith, oh, I think the broadcast stopped. So because faith, oh, it says start broadcast. Wow. We lost our internet connection. Sorry. Anyway, we'll continue without it. Because faith is an essential ingredient in the guru-disciple relationship. So we say, find that person you have faith in. Because when you have faith, you can listen. When you have faith and you listen, you can accept, you can follow. Tadbidi pranipatena pariprasnina sevaya. Submissively hear, serve, inquire. You can't do that if you don't have faith in somebody. So the other side of the equation is, if you find, there are many gurus, but you find one that inspires you more, you have faith in listening more and listening to, naturally, and you find by hearing from them and serving, can't even get on, oh yeah. You find that by hearing, okay, we're back on. You find that by hearing from them and serving them, you become especially inspired and you're advancing well in Krishna consciousness, then that's probably the person you want to accept as guru. But then you might say, well, is it bad to, everyone's accepting from this other guru because he's the one who's here in the temple. Is it bad? Is it wrong not to accept from him? That's not right or wrong. That's your decision. I would say you should not feel pressured because this is the local guru or this is the one that everyone's accepting initiation from. You shouldn't feel pressured or feel guilty that if you don't accept initiation from him, there's something wrong with you. Now, what also happens is that in the course of practicing Krishna consciousness, one may have decided to accept a guru, and later on meet another guru who inspires them and realize that this, I have connected more deeply with this other guru, and one may thereby want to accept diksha from that guru, change one's mind. So that happens, that GBC has recognized that, and they've said that if you change your guru, then you should wait another 6 months before you accept someone else. and to be initiated. And then sometimes what happens is one's initiated, but one develops a relationship with another guru. Sometimes as intimate, as close, or even more so than one's Diksha guru. And so that's also acceptable. So these are natural realities, and one will always respect one's Diksha guru. One will never disrespect one's Diksha guru if this happens. One will take permission from one's Diksha guru to hear Siksha. I think the only problem that you run into is if the Siksha ends up being contradictory or confusing. Then you have a problem. But the general principle the general reality in ISKCON is that a devotee is hearing from so many people. So it's not like a traditional system where you're only hearing from your guru. You hear every day, if you listen to class, you hear every day class from somebody else. So many sannyasis will visit your temple, you'll hear from all of them. Some of them are gurus. So you're hearing from so many people. And this is the process of Krishna consciousness. And it's not wrong if you develop an attraction to learn and hear and take guidance from any of these people. It's not only is it not wrong, it's good. And this is how we create a family. Or not create, this is how we work within the family. Family is already there. It's how we take advantage of it. Now, something very interesting I want to point out. Prabhupada, he wanted his godbrothers to work within ISKCON. How that would work, I'm not sure. But when he was leaving, he was asking us to become gurus in ISKCON, and he wasn't approaching godbrothers and saying, my disciples are not qualified, you become a guru in ISKCON, you take over. Now some people say that he asked some godbrothers or advised us to take siksha. Okay, that may be, for the sake of discussion. Some of them said that, so I don't want to argue with that. But oftentimes whenever we hear the Prabhupada said, you know, take shelter of or take guidance from, we interpret that to mean diksha, but it doesn't mean diksha. It just means hear from them. So, but there was another time in which Prabhupada said, you know, if they say anything different from what I say, then it'll ruin everything. So Prabhupada really established himself well as the founder of Acharya, and that his books would be the law books. No one else's books. He didn't say anyone else's books would be the law books, but he did say we could read other books. So how do we understand that? We understand that whatever we hear from the Acharyas or other books we read or from other devotees, it all is understood through Prabhupada's instructions, through Prabhupada's teachings, because those are the standards. And so Prabhupada labored to write these books, and then when he said they're the law books, that means that these are the foundation. So other gurus and other organizations, even within ISKCON, may write books, but they're not going to be the law books. Everything is based on Prabhupada's books. So he had asked others to help us, but it didn't mean they would supersede Prabhupada's position. It didn't ask anybody to become Diksha gurus in ISKCON. He asked his own disciples, which is kind of interesting, because some people may say, well, his disciples are not as advanced as people outside of ISKCON. But he never asked anyone else outside of ISKCON to be Diksha guru within ISKCON, at least that I'm aware of. I mean, you could say, well, he invited godbrothers to work within ISKCON, which meant that they would eventually probably take disciples. But that's not necessarily true, because Prabhupada wanted everything to work through him in charge. He wanted everything based on his books, and he told his godbrothers, you can come and help, but you must distribute my books. So he was really focused on his position as founder of Acharya and his books. And as far as we're aware of, he never called anyone from outside of ISKCON to become Diksha gurus within ISKCON, but he asked his disciples to do that. So that's an important point. And then I don't know if anybody's still here. If you all got lost me when my internet went down, which happens. But if anyone's still here and they have a question, they can ask. Otherwise, this is being recorded for posterity's sake. In case I say something valuable, then it's recorded. You never know if I do, but okay. Then the next thing comes up. Okay, is a spiritual master a pure devotee? Does one have to be a pure devotee to be a spiritual master? We kind of addressed this within the Uttama Adhikari question. Now, what you find is that a lot of times in traditional preaching, you'll say that spiritual master must be Uttama Adhikari, or he must be on a high level of Madhyam or the beginning stages of Uttama. He must be a pure devotee, otherwise he's not bona fide. And then we've also heard it said that there really aren't any bona fide gurus in ISKCON, because there are no really advanced Uttama Adhikaris. So, what do we mean by pure devotee? Well, in previous classes, we had defined, we'd use Prabhupada's definition. When Prabhupada was asked how many pure devotees are on the planet, he asked how many are in ISKCON. And they said 1,000. He said, okay, 1,000 pure devotees. So, Nectar of Devotion describes a pure devotee as one who serves Krishna without any motive, not contaminated by jnana and karma. That's a pure devotee. Do we have pure devotees in ISKCON? Yes, we have many devotees who are serving Krishna solely with the purpose of satisfying him, who want nothing to gain and only to satisfy Prabhupada. Those are pure devotees. So one definition that Prabhupada gave of pure devotee, which is more in line with Prabhupada's mood, is one who's engaged in thinking and engaged also in how to spread Krishna consciousness, although constantly. One who strictly follows the principles given by his spiritual master, and one who's always thinking how to spread Krishna consciousness. So this is the definition, I believe, which is most important, Prabhupada's most important definition for us to understand within the context of Prabhupada's preaching. I'm sure people would argue with this, and I already know what their arguments would be. Anyway, they might think I'm stupid to say this. I don't know what I'm talking about. I don't know Shastra. But I have heard their arguments. I have studied the subject, so I'm not saying this as a fanatic or out of ignorance. But Prabhupada definitely had a focus on preaching, on spreading Krishna consciousness. And one of the ways he often defined pure devotee was in terms of a person's not only ability to spread Krishna consciousness, but that was part of it, but one's absorption in the activity and one's desire to do it. So one who is always absorbed in doing it, one who's always thinking about doing it, and also one who's doing it. That was one definition of pure devotee. Of course, along with that definition, the definition one is one who is following strictly the instructions of his spiritual master. And so when we say following strictly, what do we mean? We mean a devotee who's exemplifying what Prabhupada wanted us to do. So they're rising early, they're chanting their rounds, they're following the principles, they're attending the morning program. They're engaged 24 hours a day in service, or at least they're engaged in service in their waking hours. And they're thinking about service when they're sleeping, and they're not anxious to sleep much. They want to be always engaged. This is what was Prabhupada's definition of pure devotee. There are a common definition of pure devotee. And this, in my opinion, was more valuable to Prabhupada than what you might call a more strict definition. Oh, he's an Uttama Adhikari. Because Prabhupada, it's very clear that he had a mission to spread Krishna consciousness. And it's very clear that he was not satisfied that most of his godbrothers had that vision or had a clear vision or had the desire to do it to the degree that he did. And it was very clear that he had in instilled within his disciples' hearts that desire to do that, and therefore his disciples are actually the best people to carry on what he had started, because they understood exactly what Prabhupada did, what he's trying to accomplish, what his mood was, how he explained the Shastra, how he trained new people, how he did everything, because they were trained by him. So they're actually the best people. So then you might say, well, what if someone's not an Uttama Adhikari? What if he's only a Madhyam Adhikari? Can he be Guru? Well, Madhyam Adhikari is a stage of Nishta. Nishta is a stage where you're not encumbered by Adharthas. And so Nishta is the beginning stage of pure devotee. Even though it's Madhyam, it's still the beginning stages of pure devotee. And in a broader sense, you can say, because it's pure devotee, it's really the lower, it's really part of Uttama Bhakti. So you can expand the definition. But what I'm saying is I think we also, what's most important is we also have to understand the definition of pure devotee the way Prabhupada understood it, the way Prabhupada defined it, or the way Prabhupada wanted us to be pure devotees. Okay, maybe you could say there are different kinds of pure devotees, but how did Prabhupada want us to be pure devotees? And one of the things that's very clear is a disciple who will perfectly follow the instructions of his guru, who was sold out and surrendered to his spiritual master. So this is very important for carrying on the mission that Prabhupada established, to have people that are 100% surrendered to Prabhupada. And sometimes Prabhupada's disciples were criticized. We were criticized because we didn't know the culture. Maybe even at those early days, we weren't very knowledgeable, although we understood basics. But when we were criticized, sometimes Prabhupada would acknowledge it. Yes, we have these faults. He said, but they'll do anything I ask them. And so Prabhupada saw that as the real qualification, that we'll do anything. You know, we have this story of, I've told before, of this devotee who did Ganga Parikrama. He went all on barefoot, all the way around the Ganga. And he was a sannyasi, he came back, disciple of Srila Bhakti Siddhanta. He came back to Srila Bhakti Siddhanta after he did the Parikrama, and he told him that I had done this Parikrama. And Bhakti Siddhanta said, give up your sannyas. Why Bhakti Siddhanta said this was because he actually told this devotee not to do it. And so he had disobeyed his order. So, you know, you could look at the action itself as an austerity, as something very devotional, or even a manifestation of pure devotion to do Ganga Parikrama. But because it wasn't what Srila Bhakti Siddhanta wanted, it wasn't actually Krishna consciousness. It wasn't pure devotional service, or even you could say it wasn't really even devotional service, at least not authorized devotional service. So the point being is that even maybe one is not that elevated, but one is sold out to the instructions of one's guru, one has complete faith in those instructions, one is willing wholeheartedly to do that. That was Prabhupada's definition of pure devotee. So one who's always thinking about spreading Krishna consciousness, that was Prabhupada's one of the definitions, and Prabhupada asked us, always think about spreading Krishna consciousness, right? He asked us. And one who follows the I look tired. Well, this lighting is, you know, when the lighting's not good, it makes you not look so good. Well, the weather's hot here, you know. So, I don't even know if anyone's watching anymore. I thought we lost the broadcast. But anyway, like when people would come and join ISKCON, what was very important in Prabhupada's time, that we had a very strict morning program, and so the senior leaders, they would follow, and that was really their qualification. They would follow exactly the program, and they would teach what Prabhupada taught, and they would be sold out or surrendered to spreading Krishna consciousness. So this was Prabhupada's definition of pure devotee, and these are the kind of pure devotees that Prabhupada wants, not someone maybe who could manifest, in a sense, more mature devotion on a higher level, but not have the deep faith in Prabhupada as the guru, and work within the institution that would have the most power to spread Krishna consciousness. I mean, ultimately, that's what Prabhupada wanted. Of course, if someone works outside, we can't condemn them or say they're not doing spreading Krishna consciousness. But the greatest power is to work together. So that's what Prabhupada wanted. Okay, I have to look not tired. All right. Do I look not tired now? Not that tired. I think I'm okay. It's early in the morning. Well, 6:30 in the morning. So, I think this is very important in understanding what is a pure devotee. There are many ways to define it, and they're very broad definitions. And one thing, I'm just speaking here from my personal experience in seeing how Krishna consciousness spreads and seeing how devotees do well, is that those who are dedicated, very, very dedicated to the mission of spreading Krishna consciousness under the order of their guru and under the order of Prabhupada, that's what Prabhupada wants. That's the pure devotee that Prabhupada wants. Because as I said, Prabhupada said, if you take shelter of someone who says one thing different, it can be confusing, it can be disrupting. So Prabhupada was concerned about that. Anyway, that's my take. Maybe someone is going to hear this and shoot me for saying that, but that's my understanding. But I think an important philosophical point, and I've made this many times, is that pure devotee means you serve Krishna without any motivation to become free from suffering, to get something material. It's only to satisfy Krishna. And if you're serving your guru only to satisfy him, that's pure devotional service. It may be not the most mature level of pure devotional service. You may not be on the Uttama Bhakti platform, but by definition, that's what pure devotional service is. So by the broad definition, you're engaged in pure devotional service. And by broad definition, not even by broad definition, you're engaged in pure devotional service. By broad definition, you're a pure devotee. So I think one of the ways that we became confused in ISKCON is that we thought when someone became a Diksha Guru, then they were special or different than everybody else. And that was kind of like its own category, its own tattva. And Diksha Guru simply means it's a function within the guru. It's actually an aspect of siksha, because the main function of guru is siksha. So diksha is an aspect of the function of guru. And the guru-disciple relationship is something very private. So, but somehow or other in ISKCON, it became such a public institutional position that when someone became a diksha guru, it got elevated there, or the person got elevated to some status of pure devotee that no one could, that others maybe couldn't achieve. Because you say, well, there's only 70 or 100 or 140 gurus in ISKCON out of thousands and thousands and thousands, tens of thousands of devotees, so they must be special. But there's, you know, how many teachers are there in ISKCON? How many temple presidents are there? Maybe there's 600 temple presidents out of hundreds of thousands of devotees. So are they special? Yes. Are they distinct from other devotees? No. Is the Diksha Guru special? Is he distinct? Does it mean he's more advanced? No. So, are they special kinds of pure devotees? No. Anyone who engages in pure devotional service is a pure devotee. And it has nothing to do with the service that you do, whether you're a guru or not. It has nothing to do with it. It's with who you are. So, I think that's something we need to understand. Oh, you're a Diksha Guru. Are you special? All devotees are special, but because you're Diksha Guru, you're special to your disciples, certainly. But to people in general, are you special? Do you have to be special to them? Do they have to see you as special? No. You're not their guru. So, you know, just like I'm a father to my daughter, does that mean all young girls Have to see me as special? No. Have to see me as father? No. I'm a father to my daughter. We don't have the same relationship. I'm not their father. My daughter thinks I'm the greatest in the world. Another girl does not think I'm the greatest in the world because I'm not her father. So then this goes back to how one becomes a Diksha Guru in ISKCON. Now, if you want to become a Diksha Guru in ISKCON, there's a couple of ways it can happen. One way is somebody asks you, could you be my guru? Could you give me initiation? And then the Diksha Guru will either approach the local GBC or this prospective disciple will and say, I want to be approved to initiate in ISKCON. So then they form a committee, then the committee asks some questions about the qualities of this devotee. Do you see that he's following the principles? He speaks Siddhanta like this. He's a good devotee. And if they say yes, then it goes to GBC. If after 6 months no one has any objections, then he's given a letter and say, yes, you can initiate within ISKCON. As I said, process is subject to change. Some don't want it to go to the GBC. There are so many ideas on it. Some don't even want the process. Some feel it should be proactive, where GBC should be just kind of proactively authorizing qualified people, hundreds of them, even if they don't want to be guru. But the nature of the situation in ISKCON is that the guru, he's externally, he's offered quite a lot of respect. And so a lot of devotees, in their humility, don't want to be in that position. Or even they feel that the Diksha Guru is such a special position they don't want to be in. And the point I'm making is that it's special only for the disciple. It's not a special position otherwise. Just like I'm a Diksha Guru, but I'm also a father to my daughter. So that relationship is totally different than the relationship I have with her. And I have relationships with so many devotees who just know me, who are not disciples of Prabhupada, but they're friends. So although I am a Diksha Guru to somebody, I may be a Siksha Guru to someone else, with them we're just friends. So all the relationships are different. So it doesn't mean that because I'm Diksha Guru, it's special to everybody. But we tend to think like that. It's just special to those who are the disciples. I'm not saying Diksha Gurus aren't special, but I'm saying they're not special just because they're Diksha Gurus. When you become Diksha Guru, you don't, like Prabhupada said, you don't grow four arms and become God. So now you understand. So just like last, I became approved to become a Diksha Guru in April 2013. April of 2013, I became approved. Before that, I had people asking me if I would be their guru, and we had a relationship of guru and disciple. So what has changed now that I'm approved? The only thing that's changed is now that I can actually function by giving them diksha. The relationship has remained the same. And even if I was not approved, someone else would have to give them diksha, and I would still function as their siksha guru, and the relationship would remain the same. So I'm the same person now, before I was Diksha Guru and after. My function with these disciples is the same, only now I can give them initiation. Other than that, everything is the same. Now, am I the same person? Yes, I don't have four, you probably noticed I don't have four arms. I didn't grow a long beard and I don't wear a turban. And I become a Diksha Guru. But am I different? The only difference is if I think, yes, I'm Diksha Guru, I'm special, and it'll go to my head, and then I'll be in illusion. In that sense, I'll be different. I'll be worse off if I think that way. Is the Diksha Guru different? Yeah, sometimes that happens. So in the negative sense, they become different. That's danger, because you're honored, and your disciples say, oh, you're the best. I don't see anybody better than you. And if you believe that, then you did change. Now you're in huge trouble. Srila Bhaktisiddhanta said something really interesting. He said, whenever my disciples glorify me, I think they're telling me how I should be. They're instructing me that these are the qualities that I should develop. So, oh, Gurudev, you have so much love for your spiritual master. Okay, I should have so much love for my spirit. I should develop this. That's how the guru is supposed to think. So as long as the guru thinks that way, and now he's Diksha Guru, he's not in a different tattva, in a different world. It's the same thing. He's Diksha Guru for certain devotees. He's not Diksha Guru for all of ISKCON. So within ISKCON, you know, we've made the Diksha Guru more of a, it seems more like an institutional post. Like, okay, so-and-so's GBC, so-and-so's temple president, so-and-so's Diksha Guru. But it's not exactly like that. He's only Diksha Guru for his disciples. It's not like he's Diksha Guru for anybody else. So it's not the same as being GBC or being a temple president. He's within the institution, he's functioning, but it's just for those disciples that he's Diksha Guru. Whereas temple president, you are temple president of that temple. You may not be the temple president of another temple, but that is your function of that city. You are the temple president. That's just the way it is. But if you're a Diksha Guru in that temple, you're not a Diksha Guru of everyone in that city, potentially, or in reality. You're just Diksha Guru for those who... you're only really Guru for those who see you as Guru. Whereas, you know, you're the temple... If you're the temple president, you are the temple president, whether one sees you as one or not. That's your official position. But as far as Guru, you're only Guru if people see you as Guru. So it's not... You understand, you know, so when someone, you say, oh, he's a Diksha Guru, for who? For his disciples. But other than that, it's like, okay, he's just, that's a role, a function he has, but other than that, he's a devotee. He's, you know, what's his service? What does he do? He writes books. He teaches. He's a GBC, he's in charge of this, all right? So, okay. And he's also taken the service of initiating disciples. Some Diksha Gurus have very few disciples, and they don't want a lot of disciples, and if you want to become their disciple, good luck. That they've taken that service, but that's how they're doing it. That's how they choose to do it. So you're going to find Diksha Gurus in ISKCON who maybe initiate one devotee every 3 years, who have a handful of devotees, and that's how it's going to be. That's the service they're taking. Okay, so I think we've gone about an hour now since we got a late start. And I'm going to go back. I've been reading the article. So, anyone has, Haribol Dhirodas. If anyone has any, I don't even know if anyone's still listening, but if you have any questions, I will take questions. And if you lost me, then this has been recorded. Otherwise, Prabhupada, Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur told Prabhupada, if no one comes to hear you, then just preach to the four walls. So maybe I'm preaching the four walls, but I'm also preaching to a microphone, and the microphone's recording. So that means somebody out there someday will hear it. And at the other point is that even if nobody hears this, devotional service is absolute. So preaching or speaking about Krishna consciousness is purifying me. So I'm getting so much benefit by speaking even if no one's listening. So it's absolute. Even thinking about it, you get the benefit. So, and when I was a younger devotee, one of the ways I learned to preach was just by preaching to the four walls. It's quite easy. It's a, you don't have to worry about what you say because only the four walls are listening. And so it's a... Oh, Dhiradas is here. So it's an interesting concept. And this is there in the Bhagavatam that when you speak Krishna Katha, everyone who hears it becomes purified, even the insects. And the person who speaks it becomes purified. It purifies the whole atmosphere. And Prabhupada said, I don't know where this comes from, but I've heard this in other places. He said that when lies are spoken, it contaminates the air. And then Prabhupada said that when you have these plagues, what do you call it when you have a plague? You can't think of the word. You know, there's a massive disease, like a plague. I guess there's another word anyway. But Prabhupada said, these plagues, there's another word, maybe somebody knows. So these plagues were caused by lawyers lying in court. It contaminated the atmosphere to such a degree that everyone became sick. Kind of interesting. I think it's interesting if we can contaminate the airwaves, then... I got a message on Skype. Probably everyone is on the chat and is writing. There seems to be a problem. Everyone is on the chat and writing. What does that mean? Hold on. Chat. If everyone's on the chat and writing, what's the problem? I don't know the problem. Everyone's writing. Anyway, it's interesting. If you say that this sound can contaminate and cause a plague, what's the word? Think of another word for plague. What is it? Anyway, and then, so what happens when you speak Krishna Katha? Just purifying everything. So sometimes we have to speak just to purify ourselves. So you don't even need someone to speak to. You can just speak to the walls if you like. Tell the walls what you read this morning. Tell the walls what you've learned. Tell the walls your realization. And that's why Prabhupada wanted us to write. Because when you write, Prabhupada said, do not write to be published, just write. So what are you writing for? You're writing for your own purification. That's why Prabhupada said to write. So if you speak to the four walls, it's like writing. You're speaking for your own purification. So that's powerful. Every day write, one line, two lines, write something. Simulate your realizations. I mean, simulate Krishna consciousness. Write your realization. What are you understanding? Okay, so, I don't know. All right. Krishna's listening to me. I hope I didn't offend anybody. Okay, so, was anything not clear? Let me know if anything's not clear. Some of these issues are a little sensitive in how traditional guru-disciple relationships function within an organization. And within ISKCON, ISKCON's evolving, and what ISKCON wants to do is they want to maintain the Shastric traditional position of guru and disciple, but within the context of an international organization, so the dynamics are different. And it's evolving because not everyone's satisfied with how it works, and we're learning as we go on. Isn't it true that Diksha Guru is special to others besides his disciples? I think if he is, if a Diksha Guru is special to others besides his disciples, it would be because of the relationship with that person, not because he's Diksha Guru. And the mistake would be that he's special because he's Diksha Guru. And so I was pointing that out, that that's, I think, a misunderstanding which may be quite pervasive in ISKCON. I mean, it if you heard some of the other classes, I think the last class, okay, you have a special respect, okay. So in that sense, but also sannyasis are special because they've renounced everything. And GBCs are special because and temple presidents are making so much sacrifice. So if you see the speciality of all these people, I would say yes, but if you just isolate the Diksha Guru thinking it's some kind of special tattva, I appreciate that you believe it's special that they've taken this service and responsibility, but in the other chat, I have some questions. Man, on Krishna.com, it actually came up. Okay, so I'm going to go to Krishna.com. I don't know if that answers your question. If it doesn't answer your question, then let me know. But I appreciate that you feel that their service is special. But it's like there's this story of Prithu Maharaj. I believe it was Prithu Maharaj. She was being glorified, and he said, when he was installed on the throne, he's being glorified, he said, well, don't glorify me until I do what you say I'm going to do, because they were talking about how glorious he was, and he said, I haven't done these things yet. So we don't want to, you know, we want to appreciate people not just because it's a position, but we want to appreciate them for what they are. But the fact that they take the position to make the sacrifice, yeah, I think that's glorious. But the fact that you say, well, he walks in, he's a Diksha Guru, so he must be head and shoulders more Krishna conscious than everybody else, so I listen respectfully to him. But this other devotee, he's just, you know, whatever. But he may actually be more advanced, but we may not see it. So that's what I'm saying. But should the GBC go on labeling devotees who are not very advanced and fixed up as Diksha Gurus? I think the GBC wants to get out of the business of labeling people as Diksha Gurus, because in the ultimate sense, the disciple has to label someone as Diksha Guru. I mean, there's no one to give Diksha to, and no one wants to take Diksha from you, how can you be Diksha Guru? So I think the GBC wants to get out of the business of labeling Diksha Gurus, but in the business of just making sure that this person is, as best they can, see a devotee who understands Krishna consciousness, who follows it, and then let the disciple ultimately tell the disciple, that's your decision, you have to make that decision. It's going in that direction. Is there a limit of age? No. No, there isn't. But generally, the tradition is your spiritual master should have passed away. Some situations he'll give you permission. I don't know if I've cleared anything up or confused you, or what I'm trying to do is that there's a lot of senior devotees that recognize that the way we understand Siksha Diksha in ISKCON, commonly understood, is not really always in every aspect in line with Guru, Sadhu, and Shastra. So some things I say may not jive, so to speak, with what you see and hear, have heard about in ISKCON, and I'm bringing these up. I'm bringing these things up to try to, because they're important to bring up, and this is not, you know, we don't want to create a cult. So I'm bringing this up for, you know, to get more clarity. Clarity on, you know, really what is this position of Diksha Guru? It's a service, and the Diksha Guru is a Diksha Guru for disciples. Now, if you appreciate that he's a Diksha Guru, that's wonderful. But just because he's a Diksha Guru, and it's like you think he's a special tattva, no. And see, the problem is that as long as we think that way, there are many devotees who should be Diksha Gurus who won't do it because everyone's convinced them that it's like something special, and you know, everywhere you go you're going to get your feet bathed, and everyone's going to tell you you're God, and the devotee's thinking, you know, if that happens to me, I'll fall on my face because I already think I'm God and I always want my feet bathed by everybody, but I'm trying to be a humble devotee. And if I'm in a position where people do that, then I'm finished. So many of my God brothers, I say, why don't you take disciples? And no, because we've made the Diksha Guru into something beyond what it should be. And these people who are saying, no, I don't want to take disciples, are already Siksha Gurus for many people. So it's natural they take disciples. But within the cultural context of what a Diksha Guru has become, they don't like it. So it actually is, they don't want it. So it's actually detrimental to expanding the number of people who could give initiation. And the advantage of more people giving initiation is that people get more personal care and guidance. And a lot of devotees need personal care and guidance, but if, you know, if gurus have too many disciples, it limits. Whereas if a guru has a smaller number of disciples, he can personally take care of them. I hope that makes sense. And then the other side, and we've talked about this before, if you see someone else who you see like a guru, it's not wrong. It's if there's faith, if you're inspired, then it's natural. Because for you, if you are inspired by them, if they guide you, if they help you, then you go with your heart. There's nothing wrong with that. Then for you, they're like a guru. They're like your Diksha Guru. They're Siksha. And if they're not, and if you just hear from them and they inspire you, but there's not that deep relationship, there's nothing wrong with you. That's fine also. It's not forced or natural. It's not forced. It is natural. And we respect everyone. But certain people, if you have greater faith in them, then the person you have greater faith in, when he says, don't do this, you'll have the power to do it. If you just go to a class and someone says, don't do it, and you don't have great faith, you'll say, I can't. I have to do it. If you have great faith in someone and they say, don't do it, you get the power not to do it. Say, my guru doesn't want me to do this, so I'm not going to do it. So that's the importance of faith. So we say, at least we should have that faith in one person, if not more than one. And usually that one person becomes the Diksha Guru. But it may become someone else also. Yes, after Prabhupada's example, many think they need to come up to his standard to be guru. That was what we talked about in the last class. And that created a huge problem. Prabhupada's position was special. Pure devotee, sent by Krishna to spread Krishna consciousness, the founder of Acharya Viscon, that no one is expected to be guru on that level. And there may be gurus in our movement who are very much on that level because they have that shakti and that power and they have thousands of disciples. But that doesn't mean that the guru who only has 20 disciples is no less powerful and no less more bona fide or genuine, and that he can sit on a humble cushion on the floor. That's okay. He doesn't have to sit on a big seat. See, the real thing for the disciple is to respect, to have faith and respect the guru, especially respect and follow his instructions. The externals, not that important. Once the devotees wanted, were talking with Prabhupada, and after they finished talking, they were taking darshan, and Arjuna said, Prabhupada, can I touch your feet? And Prabhupada said, "Not, it's not required." So a lot of these other things, they're things we may like to do, but they're not really required. The real thing is hearing and following. That's so important. Hear and see a little live. We'll try to find out when here to see more. This broadcast, I have a YouTube channel, Mahatma Das. You can find it. And then this broadcast, the audio of it, within a few days it'll go up there. So and then the other ones on Guru Tata will go up there. And it's an important topic. ISKCON is evolving in their understanding of Guru Tattva. And as it evolves, it's interesting, as it evolves, you go back to Shastra and see that it's evolving, and what it's evolving more towards is what was in the Shastra, but due to many circumstances, it was difficult to understand it. And it's just that there's so many gurus that you can all take advantage of. And often what happens is, if one can only hear from one's Diksha Guru, it becomes a problem. Because one of the problems we see is that some devotees, they don't do that well in spiritual life because they can't really hear from others. So their spiritual master comes, they get inspired, they hear from him. And when their spiritual master is not there, then they don't come, they don't hear from others, and this is not good. This happened when Prabhupada was here. It's a problem. And then Srila Bhaktisiddhanta said something really, really powerful. He said, the real test of the disciples, how can you know who is a really, how did he say it? The real test, or the real test of the qualification of the disciple, is when the spiritual master leaves. Because that's how you really know. Because now the spiritual master is not there pushing. It's all now faith in his instructions. And so that's the real test, and that's really what you know what the spiritual master is made of. And it's not that we don't want to be with the spiritual master and get inspiration from them. But the real test is, okay, what did they say? What do they want me to do? And how do I integrate with the other devotees? Because Prabhupada really wanted us to integrate well with the other devotees. So how do I integrate with other devotees? Am I offending other devotees? Am I able to work with them? If I can't work with them, at least do I keep my distance respectfully so I don't offend them and respect them from a distance? Like that. Okay. So why don't we stop now? This could go on for many yugas, but hopefully we'll continue on Saturday. Yeah.